This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
Want to know what's going on in your neck of the woods and learn the history and the people behind the events that you love across the state? Get to know the real Mississippi. Check out MPB Think Radio's Next Stop Mississippi podcast on all platforms or on the MPB Public Media app.
You're listening to Deep South Dining, and today is a special drive time episode of the show. And we'll start today's show, as we do each and every Monday morning, by taking a peek into the personal kitchens of Malcolm and Carol.
When we're talking food, I went old school. And, you know, I love to read every morning what the New York Times recipe of the day is. Yeah. And Malcolm, it was a tuna melt.
A tuna melt?
Who knew? Wow. That the New York Times would be pimping.
Did they use yellowfin? Was it canned tuna?
No, they didn't. It was really old school. But what kind of interested me and what I wanted to tell you, that legend has it that the tuna melt was accidentally invented in the 60s at the Woolworth's lunch counter in Charleston, South Carolina. And it was when a cook did not notice that a bowl of tuna salad tipped over onto the grilled cheese.
Oh.
And the rest is history.
Indeed, it may
not be true, but it sounds...
It sounds like Deep South Dining.
Yeah, it sounds reasonable, but this tuna melt had, you know, extra sharp cheddar. Of course, they had to do something different, so they used, like, cornichons, but... John Palmer was pretty darn happy watching football and eating an old school tuna melt.
I just don't see it.
I mean, you don't see it on menus.
No.
Remember Shoney's, all these people used to have a tuna melt.
Well, I lived on tuna melts when I was out in California. We had them almost every night because it was what we could afford, and it was fun. You would make the sandwiches, wrap it in aluminum foil, put it in the oven, and put it on very low until it toasted, and you bring it out, and it was crisp and melted all the way through. We didn't cook it like a grilled cheese. We actually put it in the oven in foil, and it makes
cool.
It's a slow cook. Well, it's not a cook. It's a warm-up. Everything's already cooked.
I bet it turns gooey.
Very gooey and very good.
Well, you know what? Let's bring the tuna melt back.
Let's do it.
Fishing season now with brim. So there's a lot of fried. There's a lot of fried stuff
going on
at our house.
I love
and
the fried
love
brim.
To have you over, you and Kara, over to fry some brim because they are plentiful right now.
Well, I just got a new reel for my fly rod. I got a lightweight 4 ounce, which is perfect for catching brim on. So I'm going to head out that way with my fly rod.
Nothing more fun than catching brim. You know, there's a group on Facebook called Brim on the Fly, and it's a group of people up in the Delta, I believe, started it.
Wow.
So it's a thing. One of the great things I cooked over this weekend was a one-pot Chermoula shrimp and orzo. You know, I've been on a Moroccan flavor kick.
As you well should be.
I know. And, you know, chermoula is kind of akin to South American chimichurri.
Okay.
And it's, you know, lots of chopped up, finely chopped parsley and cilantro, you know, cumin in it.
It's chopped.
It's chopped, very finely chopped. I think a lot of people do it in the food processor, but... Mm. I like to chop.
Well, Kara made a herb reduction this weekend that we put over boiled shrimp, and it had mint, basil, parsley, maybe some cilantro, and she, you know, reduced it down to a liquid, and we used it for a topping on the boiled shrimp. It was really nice.
It sounds like a fine dining restaurant at your house.
Well, I'm fortunate. My wife loves to cook. It's sort of her hobby. When she has time, she loves to get in and experiment with recipes. And I help some. And then I cook my own stuff on the side. But and I had a great meal on St. Patrick's Day down at Hallam Mow's. They served the traditional corned beef, cabbage, carrots, and potatoes. It was really delicious. And I want tip of the hat to Damien for carrying on that tradition and doing his own sort of style with it. It was really good.
Fantastic. I saw so much corned beef and cabbage on Cooking and Coping this week. You know, people were so creative, but lots of people cooking for St. Paddy's Day.
Yep. And a lot of crawfish boiling going on.
Lots.
'Tis the season for all of that.
And I brought a photograph for you. I think the Cooking and Coping post of the weekend was Barbara Tuccio's frog leg salad.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, look
I missed
at this.
It.
Yeah. She's one of my favorite posters.
Frog
I love
legs.
What she does.
Look at that. You know, we used to frog gig when I was a kid, and they were plentiful, and we would often have frog legs. They were more often than not, they were fried.
Right.
But this version looks so yummy.
It looks so yummy. And I asked what it would take for her to come cook those for my husband. And it just, you know, food people are so nice. She immediately wrote back and said, yes, I'm in.
Great.
I won't be there because I kind of have a little weird thing about frog legs.
Oh, you don't
but
like
John
them.
Will be mm-hmm. so happy.
Java, you partake of the frog legs?
I do. That's why I was looking at Carol a little, you know, a piffed. If that's a word. I was like, what's wrong with
we'll
the frog?
We'll make it a word. What's wrong, a
with,
piffed.
The what's wrong with the frog legs?
Is it a texture thing? Or is it just knowing
little,
that?
No, it's just you're just a little jumpy for me.
A little. Oh, that's
perfect. I mean, I've tasted them. They taste wonderful. Uh-huh. Arno's has them, but it's just a little visual.
Okay.
Okay, yeah.
But you're good with the quail.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't explain.
It's the twitching, perhaps.
It's the twitching. But Java, Tony's in Vicksburg, which is on Highway 61 going up toward the Delta.
Mm-hmm.
They sell really good Louisiana frog legs.
Okay.
I have to buy them because my husband likes them so much. But in other places, the frog legs are very large and from China. But if you want some Louisiana frog legs, mm-hmm. that's your place.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, at my house, we are, Malcolm, I'm having some marital issues.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, and it's over food. I mean, I take great pride in cooking three meals a day for John. You know, we're 25.
You're out in the country.
We are 25 or 30 minutes from a quart of milk. So, you know, you have to plan ahead. But John has been rejecting my food in favor of Renita's food at Lee's Heavenly Barbecue and Soul Food Restaurant.
Well, let me say this. Back in the day, and I'm going to guess this was 10 or 15 years ago, David Patterson was working on a construction project somewhere out in Edwards, and I would go out there with him, and we would go to Lee's, and it was rocking and rolling back then. So that place has been around a while.
Well, all I know, it's made a big impression on my household. And
you got a resentment?
Well, I do have a resentment because I'm showing you this recipe.
Okay.
Pan-seared chicken with harissa, dates, and citrus. This is what I was making for dinner Friday night.
You wouldn't get that at Lee's?
No, you would not get that at Lee's Heavenly Barbecue and Soul Food. And John rejected that dish, and I'm going to share with you what the menu was on Friday at Lee's. Smothered pork chops, catfish, pulled pork, spaghetti, baked chicken, and rib tips. Now, what he chose to do, since it was Catfish Friday, he had catfish for lunch and then wanted the smothered pork chops for supper.
Instead of the fancy
instead
chicken
of pan-seared
dish.
Chicken with harissa dates and citrus. So,
well, you're going to need
know,
a little
I'm feeling
counseling.
Bad. I'm
you're
feeling
need
bad.
A little work.
Yeah, I'm feeling bad this. About myself, and I've got to learn how to make smothered pork chops.
Okay.
I normally pan-sear it and then stick it in the oven, you know, pork chops. And then baste and drizzle like a peach jalapeno glaze.
Okay, hold
on.
There's the problem. First of all, you said drizzle versus smothered.
Yes.
John wants smothered, and you're drizzling.
And I'm drizzling. So help me, people. Help me with the smothered pork chops.
Before you put the pork chop back in the oven, you're going to have to smother it.
Yes.
In some gravy.
Yes.
Broth.
Yes.
Reduction.
So
onions.
I need some help here, and then I'm going to invite you and Java to Catfish Friday soon.
You're listening to Deep South Dining. It's a special Drive Time episode. Now, let's go back in time to one of my favorite episodes where Malcolm and Carol were visited in studio by their favorite fishmonger.
It's Monday morning. It's Deep South Dining. Carol Palmer, Malcolm White.
And guess who we have in the studio?
We have someone else in the studio. John Lester has joined us here. Good morning, John.
Morning, all.
He's a Mississippi celebrity.
He is. Yeah. So you got a fan base out there.
Yeah, yeah. We've been around a while. And,
yeah, tell our listeners the story of Dugan's, because we have people from all over the state that don't know about the...
All over the world.
All over the world.
We're big in Portugal.
In Portugal and Peru.
You know, Dugan's been around since 73. Earl and Laura were from Baton Rouge area. He was born on the Mississippi coast. She was born around the Baton Rouge area. And came up, and they just first started selling shrimp out in front of Howard Brothers. You know where Howard Brothers was? It's right next to the Kroger on I-55 years ago. It was a precursor to Walmart kind of thing.
Wow. Yeah, I forgot about that place.
Yeah. That shows your age if you know that place. anyway, they...
If you remember 1973, it shows your age.
So they were selling shrimp only. And the way that we got to the DeVille Plaza corner was... He was trying to figure out how to get across the interstate over there to the motel, and he had pulled in that parking lot, turned around, and about four people cornered him with their vehicles and wouldn't let him leave till they got their shrimp. And we've been there ever since. And
he sold out of the back of a pickup truck
with a camper on it. Hmm.
And his wife, Sweetie...
Mm-hmm. Laura
sat in the back, and they had a scale hanging.
So it's been a rustic kind of existence. We changed it, Sheila and I, a year or two in after Doogie passed, to using it's really a modified snow cone trailer, like a little food trailer.
Mm-hmm.
That way, both of us could be inside. We could have two lines going, have a little break from the elements, and had more room to provide more selection.
And you're there 2 days a week, right?
Thursday and Friday, 10 to 6.
And, Carol, as I approached John's snow cone trailer for some crab meat and some lemon fish the other day, I got there right at 10 because you told me he opened at 10. I'd been there earlier, and I said, he's not here.
Malcolm was stressed out. He texted
well,
me
I wouldn't
at
say
seven,
stressed out, but yeah.
It's 7:30. Well, there were several exclamation points.
There's no seafood truck.
He's not here.
You told the story about Dugan getting surrounded when he pulled in the lot. When I stepped out of my car and walked up to John's trailer, like nine people poured out of their cars and got right in line behind me, queuing up to be first in line. And somehow I sort of felt like I got ahead of them, but I wasn't really planning to do that.
Yeah, sometimes the line, even on 100-degree days, are long, long, long. But people who shop there expect it.
Yeah, and we try to give a good product and good service. People... You know, I hate seeing people wait in line, but it's almost like a tradition. People that hadn't seen each other in years, sorority sisters hadn't seen each other in 20 years, or sometimes you'll see three generations of the same family in line. So it's kind of a meeting place.
Another thing that fascinates me about standing in line is how many people are there from other places.
Sure.
And, I worked in the Delta for a number of years, and you'll always see people that have driven down from Greenwood, Greenville, Indianola, Cleveland to buy fish.
I think we irritate the doctors because people make their appointments on Thursdays and Fridays, so it'll coincide with us being there. And some of those guys are trying to leave at noon, you know. They come from all over the state, and from we get folks from Louisiana.
Yeah, from like Monroe. Mm-hmm. I've met people from Monroe in line, and also people from South Mississippi in the fall who are on their way to a football game in Starkville or Oxford will come with huge ice chests To get shrimp.
To go tailgate up, you know, in at Oxford or in Starville, yeah.
So were you a Dukin's customer?
Of course. I met Doogie when he was there in front of the Kroger, the Howard Brothers, with my mom when I was a teenager. And we just hit it off and had a relationship for years. He was kind of like my dad. I knew him for 40-something years, you know. And I used to be a network guy for LDDS and WorldCom and other places, the Department of Education. But anyway, a lot of times Doogie would like to take old computer equipment and we would revamp it and give it to shut-in folks with that couldn't get out that he knew of down in Baton Rouge or up here. And so we...
And he lived in Baton Rouge.
He did. He was born in Gulfport. But he lived in Baton Rouge most of his life.
And then they would come up and they would spend the night
in the same
hotel room.
There's a method to the madness on the Thursday-Friday deal is that Monday, Tuesday, everybody's back to work, back to school. You rely on the old standby recipes and stuff. Wednesday night, a lot of people eating at church. By Thursday and Friday, you can see the weekend, and you're starting to think about, hey, let's do a steak, let's do some seafood, let's do something a little more elaborate.
So, John, before you bought Dugan's, which you bought it in what year?
I think it was 2008.
Okay. Before that, you had a career, a multiple-pronged career.
Yeah,
you were, as you say, you were a network guy, IT guy, you worked for the state.
But
you were a restaurant guy.
I was.
And I were in the same business for a long time. You worked at Main Harbor. You worked at the Lamar. Talk about those days.
And we also worked at Oliver's back in the day.
So did I.
As did Mel.
Yep.
What year were you at Oliver's, or years?
It was right as it started.
With Latham and Joey
Mitchell.
Latham
was my assistant manager, and Joey Mitchell was the main manager.
Right.
Yeah. And I can remember when there were 25-cent oysters in the bar at happy hour at Oliver's. You know?
Yeah. Well, that was one of my creations. And little baby was my shucker.
Yeah.
But anyway, he recently had
Chef Sterling was there.
That's right. Sterling, yeah. Man, that's great.
So were you in the kitchen?
Yes, ma'am. I was a sous chef or assistant chef. Loved it.
Well, John, this solves a mystery for me because, you know, one of the things I love about coming and buying from you is that you always share a recipe or a how to do something. And I hear you doing that with the other customers when I'm waiting in line. And I told Malcolm, I knew you were a great cook, but I had no idea you had been a professional.
You know, people get intimidated by seafood more than they do most other foods. Mm-hmm. And I like to help them with that and clear the mystique and the mystery. And it's fairly simple. Most seafood is fairly hot and fast. So get your sides ready, have everything ready to go. And, you know, you're going to go in pretty quick and you're out. And so don't be scared of it.
And don't overcook.
Don't overcook. That's the main thing, hot and fast, you know. And if you seal it up with a, you know, like if you're trying to pan sear some fish or something, it's going to be great. And you don't need to worry about a sauce if you start out with a great first product, you know, initial product.
You're listening to a special Drive Time episode of Deep South Dining. And today we are looking for your support. But we also love supporting our Mississippi homegrown businesses. Here is a piece of a conversation when Mike Wagner from Two Brook Farms joined Malcolm and Carol.
Oh. Mike Wagner, a giant among rice farmers, one of our, you know, beloved cooking and coping members, a rock star.
A rock star indeed. Took us years to get him on the show. Welcome, Mike Wagner.
Thank you for having me. I'm bashful, and this may be the last time I ever speak to anyone in my life.
Oh, no, man. We met your son, by the way, at the Mardi Gras event in Drew. He came by and was so kind and thoughtful and said hello to all of us. You, as you may know, Carol and Java and I were the grand marshals.
Yeah, he offered us plenty of rice, Mike. So if you're missing a couple bags of product, then you have to look to your son.
we have plenty more. Don't run out down there.
But I want to set the stage for you, Mike. We're sitting here in the studio with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 samples of your rice.
And I've claimed Scarlet and the Miss Mighty. These are mine.
And Leanne Galt prepared these for us so we could not only enjoy them, but eat them while we talk to you. So
and we're fighting over this. There's one that's the Miss Mighty with goat cheese Midlands with roasted shallots and lemon. And we're fighting.
It's tough to eat and talk, but we're doing the best we can, Mike.
Well, you'll have a nap in 30 minutes after all of that.
So tell us, where is the rice farm or farms?
Mainly it's in my imagination, I think. it's a kind of a state of mind, but I farm in Tallahatchie County, which is halfway between Greenwood and Clarksdale, farm in the middle of nowhere, and it straddles LaFleur, Tallahatchie, and we farm a little bit in Sunflower County. Had the land for 30 years, and I'm tenth generation to farm. This is be our family's 270th or 72nd straight crop in the United States.
Wow! So you got in early, I suppose.
Well, yeah, they rolled stones at my folks in Scotland, so they came in 1650 to Boston and started farming in the Shenandoah Valley in 1742. And I've been farming ever since. We wore out land, and I finally figured out how to quit wearing out my land.
Yeah, so when did rice start being grown in the Mississippi Delta?
I think in the 40s or 50s, and there was some people from South Louisiana that came up on some of the less desirable cotton land on the heavy clay buckshot. And if you're down in Washington County, everyone down there claims to have had the first rice farm in their family. But it was grown, and then it spread to Tunica and Tallahatchie and certainly Bolivar County, which is the largest rice-producing county in the state.
Now, you work hard to make your rice sustainable and grown properly. Talk about what you do to produce healthier rice and what that's all about to you.
Well, I'm going to tell you how it came about, because I'm not a very good farmer and I'm a cheapskate, and I didn't have a lot of resources to spend, and I started noticing things that actually benefited from not spending money and farming with less. Less is more in this case, but we were able to incorporate wildlife. We kind of inserted our farm back into I'm a tree hugger and we kind of inserted our farm back into the local environment and ecology. I like to say that we try to grow rice for mankind and nature, and
that includes birds, I guess, huh?
Birds, it all starts in the soil. It's bacteria and viruses and fungi and algae, and they support every degree of mollusk and crawfish, and then shorebirds and ducks and snakes and turtles and everything else. And those ducks and geese fertilize, probably supply 2/3 of our fertilizer. So,
wow.
I can take you to different parts of the farm just about blindfolded and taste the soil and know about where it came from on my place.
How many different types of soil do you have that you farm?
I have two. I have about 100 acres of what might be considered marginal cotton land, and then I have a few thousand acres of what would be considered very tough, heavy clay soils, buckshot.
Gotcha. So the famous alluvial soil of the Mississippi Delta, do you grow in any of that, or are you more on the edge there?
No, I'm right smooth in the middle of it.
In the middle of it.
I can tell you, I can tell you a little story. I've Irish well digger years ago that was at 85 feet with his equipment, and he heard a
clanking in the pipes, and he was fond of taking a drink at one, and at two, he dove down in the sluice pit and dug out what he heard clanking, and it was a meteor. I have it. Whoa. I'm looking at it, sitting in my office, 85 feet deep.
Wow.
That's how deep these soils are.
Goodness. And all of this, as I understand it, I'm certainly not in the business, is comes from the river, from the flooding of the river, right?
Yes, they. You know, we're told at one time the Gulf of Mexico extended up here. So, my farm is at 120 feet above sea level. So I suspect it was. Maybe the waters were deeper back then. But anyway, I expect we were under water at one time, and it's all filled in by the Mississippi River, the whole North America.
So, Mike, talk to us a little bit about the different varieties that you grow, and why you have selected these, and is it because of the market or because your farm is just sort of designed to grow this type of rice?
Some of that, economics, health. I used to be chairman of the Western Hemisphere's rice promotions, and I would travel back and forth primarily through Latin America, the huge varieties, rice eaters down there, 130 to 150 pounds per capita. We're about 25 pounds in the U.S. Was flying back one day, and it occurred to me, I don't know what I'm doing promotions down there for when we have a food desert in our own backyard. And that's when I built a mill, and we were the kind of long-grain rice I grow is a high amylose rice versus amylopectin. It's a straight-line starch. It's healthier for diabetics. And it goes into your blood system.
What is the name of that rice?
We call it Delta Bell. It's a rather old variety. It's not the top yielder, but it's consistent in its milling qualities and its health attributes. It's not an aromatic variety, but eaten fresh, when it's fresh milled, it's a rock star. It's a firmer textured rice. Then we have what we call Misamati. We have that in brown and white. And then the brokens are turned into the Midlands or the grits. We have a jasmine. We have, we're working on a short grain we're going to call Misasushi. That'll be a sushi rice, of course. We have black rice we call sable. It is ridiculously healthy with anthocyanins and fiber. And we have a red rice called scarlet, which has been researched by the National Institute of Health and the University of, or the USDA. It's great for colon issues. It's very digestible and adds compounds, phenols is what they're called, to your diet. Very healthy rice.
It's been a lot of fun to see through our Facebook page, Cooking and Coping, which you have been so generous sharing your knowledge with people. That this rice is really made for cooks, and I love seeing when somebody tries it for the first time. They are such an appreciative audience, and seeing the recipes that people come up with, the scarlet and the sable and the Misamati, it really catches the imagination of cooks who want to take their food to the next level. I know that people have been ordering from you, but tell our listeners how they can get the rice.
Well, you can call me. My cell is 662-458-0009, and I can mail you some. But other than that, my kids tell me to shut up and go farm, and they'll take care of the marketing. They have a website. It's twobrooksfarm.com, and then they sell in Jackson and the Summit to Floor Butchers, a little on the coast. There's a little in Memphis. It's scattered around. And it's a pretty widely distributed in food service. There's lots served around the state and in the South. But to be honest with you, I just have to bring you rice. I don't know.
You're listening to a special Drive Time episode of Deep South Dining. And that's to end today's episode with one of Malcolm and Carol's favorite subjects. I'm talking cookbooks. This is a clip of when they were joined by Jennifer Branock and Andrew Haley from the Community Cookbook Project at the University of Southern Mississippi.
Nobody loves cookbooks more than Malcolm and me. We have been friends for decades, and we have been collecting and swapping, and Malcolm is actually a cookbook finder.
Finder of the cookbook. That's right. I love them. And particularly the community cookbooks, which leads us to tell us about the project, Jennifer, and what's going on with the Community Cookbook Project.
Sure. So probably about 10 years ago, we had a very small collection of cookbooks, probably about five or six. And Andrew and I had talked about the cookbooks before and started to go on a campaign to start collecting Mississippi community cookbooks primarily. And so we've been collecting cookbooks for about 10 years, both from Mississippi, but we also collect around Louisiana and Alabama and some of the surrounding areas. Then, of course, along the way, people, you know, have more than just community cookbooks. So we end up taking their, you know, national cookbooks, Julia Child, you know, French bread cookbooks, things like that to help kind of round out the collection.
And how many, more or less, or do you know exactly how many are in your collection today?
We have about 5,000 titles total, probably about 1,800 Mississippi community cookbooks, and that's not including the different editions because we do collect all the different editions because there are different recipes and different covers and things like that.
Right.
So, yeah.
So, Andrew, talk a little bit about the importance of the community cookbook and its storytelling aspect, not only the recipes, but sort of the histories that are buried within these pages.
So community cookbooks, especially in Mississippi, are a record of local life, an easily lost record of local life. Since these were usually written by women and women's groups, they were not always collected by libraries and archives as other government documents were. And so we have community cookbooks that represent towns that no longer exist or were the only publication in that community outside of maybe some government documents. And in particular, they can help us understand not just how people ate, but how they lived their lives. Since most of these community cookbooks were charity cookbooks, they were raising money for various causes. They tell us what women in those communities, and primarily women, what women in those communities cared about in the past.
Well, I'm just going to give an example of that this morning. We had a caller last week. I believe it was Jesse Malcolm. He was getting ready to go squirrel hunting. Who
yes.
knew that squirrel season
was upon us.
Was upon us. I told Malcolm I did not know squirrel had its own season.
That's right. Well, then, of course. It's Mississippi.
I know, but it's a rodent.
To some.
To some. Okay. Anyway, we talked about fried squirrel on the radio, and I went home and dug out this copy of Billy Joe Cross's Cooking Wild Game and Fish. And I owned a gourmet store for 30-something years, so you know, was very familiar with this one. And there is a whole chapter on squirrel. And, you know, it just led me to look through this and what you're talking about the life of our state. What is more Mississippi than game? And to be able to go to this is a great resource.
I will expand your horizons here, Carol. The 1958-59 Chula Garden Club cookbook, my absolute favorite page of any Mississippi cookbook. The top recipe submitted by a local white woman is for squirrel stew. And then it's followed by a recipe also submitted by a local white woman for chop suey. And the final recipe submitted by a Syrian Lebanese immigrant is she calls it cabbage tamale, but it's really for rolled cabbage. So you have squirrel stew, chop suey, and a Lebanese dish on the same page.
Chop
suey.
That is
Mississippi cooking.
Yeah, what a 50s thing. And, you know, I was showing Malcolm the squirrel recipes, and there are two recipes for squirrel and dumplings.
Hmm. So tell our listeners who might be interested in donating books or seeing the collection online, sort of tell us where they can see it, how they can be involved, how they can donate books, how that process is curated.
Sure. So you can just send them to, you can contact me, Jennifer Brannick at USM. And, you know, if you're local, we'll come get them. You know, we don't take, we're getting to the point now that we've got so many cookbooks that a lot of people have, so we might not be able to keep all of them, but we are looking to fill in a lot of gaps, whether it's new stuff or stuff from, you know, we're particularly interested in ones before 1970, community cookbooks.
We had some amazing donors who gave us 1,000 or more cookbooks. Now we have to be a little bit more selective because the library is running out of room for our books. but there are still older cookbooks that we are trying to locate. And one of our big objectives for years now has been to locate older African-American community cookbooks. There is not a single cookbook that we've been able to even identify by title. Published by an African-American civic group or church group prior to the 1970s.
You're listening to a special Drive Time episode of Deep South Dining. Hopefully you have enjoyed the conversation Malcolm and Carol bring to you every Monday morning, because it is brought to you by you, listener-supported radio. That is what we are here at MPB. Deep South Dining is a production of Mississippi Public Broadcasting and is funded by the generous contributions from listeners like you.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. To hear previous shows, visit mpbonline.org or download the MPB Public Radio app to listen on your iPhone or Android phone on demand.